Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. And if you're young and uninsured, Uncle Sam wants you by next Monday. This is a big week for the Affordable Care Act. For most uninsured Americans, next Monday, March 31st, is the deadline to buy a policy or face a fine. It's mostly younger, healthier, uninsured people who are holding out. The government announced an extension for some people yesterday, but not for most. And of particular interest to young single people, there was more Obamacare contraception coverage action at the Supreme Court yesterday, with implications for much more than health care, too. The question, can a for-profit company exempt itself from the laws of the land based on religious objections? Can a corporation, as opposed to a person, even be recognized as having a religion? So with us for an Affordable Care Act update and to take your questions if you're not sure how this deadline affects you is Susan Dentzer, Senior Policy Advisor to the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, formerly Editor-in-Chief of the journal Health Affairs and Health Policy Analyst for the PBS NewsHour. Hi, Susan. Welcome back to WNYC.
Great to be with you, Brian.
And listeners, our phones are open at 212-433-WNYC for your Affordable Care Act deadline questions. Susan, can you remind us of the consequences of failing to have health insurance? We'll review in a minute who is required to buy a policy by Monday, but what's at stake for those who are required and don't do it?
If you essentially cannot qualify for any of a number of exemptions, that is to say, you can apply to the government for a so-called hardship exemption in certain circumstances. You can apply for an affordability exemption. And you can also apply for an exemption on the basis of religious belief.
And I want to go over those exemptions in a little more depth later. But assuming you don't qualify
sure.
for one of those exemptions.
Well, and that's sorry it takes a while to get to this. But assuming you don't qualify for any of those things, you are subject then to a penalty if you do not have health insurance, which will mean that next year when you file your tax return, due April 15th of 2015, you're going to have to check a box that says that you've got health insurance or not, and potentially you will need, if audited, to provide proof of that. If you can't show that, you will be subject to the penalty, and the penalty is equal to $95 per individual or 1% of income, whichever is greater.
Of your taxable income?
Of your taxable income.
So 1% of your taxable income. If you make $50,000 of taxable income this year, your tax bill would go up by $500.
Exactly.
More than the $95. If you're at the average income for Americans, which is about $50,000, $100,000 of taxable income, it goes up by $1,000, et cetera. Are we seeing yet whether that formula is high enough to act as an incentive? Let's say you're a young single person, 30 years old, making $50,000. What does the cheapest insurance policy cost after whatever government subsidy that person would qualify for? Do you happen to know that number?
It's going to be highly dependent, obviously, on whether you're eligible for any subsidies through the exchange when you're buying coverage.
Right. But is that dependent on income and family status? So, for example, is it a simply knowable number if we were to look it up to say if you're 30 years old and you're making $50,000 and you're single, you will qualify for X dollars in government subsidy toward your policy?
Yes, you could find that out. The truth of the matter is most likely that you would not be qualified. At $50,000, you would probably not be qualified for a subsidy. And the point is, in essence, health insurance is still going to be more expensive than paying that penalty. There's no question about it for many, many individuals. I think the broader point here, two points really. One is, it is true that the mandate penalties are relatively lower than many people would have liked. And the insurance community in particular felt that the penalties needed to be higher to really spur people to buy coverage. That's unarguably true. However, it is also the case that if we look at the one example that we have in the United States of these penalties being in place and what the effect was on people buying coverage, which is Massachusetts. Massachusetts also had a very low penalty in the early days of its health insurance reform. But we now look at that state and 98% of people in the state are covered. So what it tells you is that the penalty doesn't have to be particularly big to spur a lot of movement to coverage. And what those who've looked at the Massachusetts situation conclude is that the big change was not the threat of the financial penalty. The big change was that the social norm, if you will, got altered, and that all of the discussion about having health insurance, the new avenues that were created through the existence of a new exchange, the kind of everything that was in the ether about having health insurance and why it was necessary to have that and desirable to have that, that that caused a social shift, and that the expectation on the part of many people became not how can I get away with not having health insurance, but don't I really need to have this, and isn't the penalty just another reason to prompt me to enroll in health insurance?
So we'll see, as one of the fundamental questions here, whether that takes hold as a cultural norm nationwide as it did in Massachusetts. Let's take a phone call.
Absolutely.
Jane in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jane.
Hi there. Thank you so much for taking my call. So my question is regarding if I get health insurance, I'm looking for work, and I really don't want to go through the rigmarole of signing up for additional health care if I'm going to then have a benefits package coming my way. So say if in June I got, a job with benefits, and then come April 2015 I'm able to check the box, would it make a difference if I hadn't been insured from January to June?
There is an ability in the law to have a sort of a comfort zone. I shouldn't say the law, but it's really the regulations that have been set. So I believe the answer is you would not be subject to a penalty in that instance. But frankly, it is worth checking this out if you're really interested and desperate to avoid even $95. It's probably worth talking to one of the enrollment counselors on, if you're in New York State, you can call the New York State Exchange and ask about that, or you can also submit a question to healthcare.gov.
Jane, why wouldn't you want to sign up for insurance?
Well, currently I am in an independent contractor role, mm-hmm. and it's a real estate position. It has not been lucrative this year at all. So it's just very hard for me to show income or ways of showing income, and looking for work full time. This is just sort of something that's kind of like been in my way that I have to deal with. But I'd much rather work on the full solution to the problem, which is a job with a benefits package.
Right. Make sure you.
I will say, if you're not showing any income, you're probably. Are you in New York State?
Mm-hmm.
You're probably eligible for Medicaid. So you have really very little to lose
right.
by signing up for coverage.
Okay.
Jane, good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ibrahim in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Ibrahim.
Yeah, hi, good morning, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. I'm sorry, my voice is a little husky. I got some cold. I'm a cab driver, okay? And last weekend, the Taxi Workers Alliance had a fair for us where they had a group of people, I think from Emblem, who came in to help us sign up for the health insurance. This is something we desperately need. But when I started the process, according to the lady who was helping me, they only go by gross income. My gross income includes my lease, it includes my gas expense, it includes several other expenses. So when I file my taxes, I do the Schedule C itemized deduction. So I think they should go by the adjustable gross income, which is a taxable income, instead of going according to the gross income.
Right. And Ibrahim, that's a fascinating question. And I think we learned, Susan, from you earlier that they go by the adjusted taxable income for what your penalty would be if you don't have health insurance. But he's making it sound like they go by your gross income for determining what your subsidy would be. Do you know?
Yes, well, this is an area of great confusion because there are different income standards in different parts of the law. For example, in Medicaid, the number used is the modified adjusted gross income. There are two questions here. One is what your actual subsidy is going to end up being, and the other question is what have you been told that your subsidy is. I would say just go ahead and proceed through the process and see, because there are preliminary estimates made about what your subsidy might be that might be different from what your actual subsidy would
be. Because the website, now that it's actually working, presumably, is going to give him maybe a more accurate reading on his subsidy than the person he spoke to?
Oh, quite possibly.
Ibrahim, good luck. Let's talk about some of the exempt groups. People who can remain uninsured and not pay the tax penalty, including, I've read, 14 categories of hardship exemptions, like for being homeless or having a death in the family or filing for bankruptcy. Are those the main ones?
There are three classes of exemptions. One is the hardship ones that you just mentioned. And there are quite a number of categories there. And all of that, by the way, I should say, HHS.gov does have excellent information about this on its website. So those who really want to dig deeply into these areas can find information about that. But that is one class of exemptions, is the hardship exemptions. The others are the affordability exemptions, and that has to do with your income and whether you're able to find or whether you're offered an insurance policy that is within a certain parameter of your income.
Oh, and I want to talk about that parameter, because I think this is an underreported and underdiscussed detail. It's if you can't find a policy that costs less than 8% of your income, then you're exempt. Do I have that right?
That's right.
So if you're that person making $50,000 a year, do the math, you're only required to buy insurance if you can find it for $4,000 or less.
That's correct.
Are policies at that price available?
Yes, particularly if you buy, if you're a younger person and you buy a catastrophic policy. And you can buy, in order to fulfill the requirement and avoid the penalty, you can buy a catastrophic policy, and almost certainly one will be available for that sum. Or even less. So that's that is a particular feature that was put into the law, especially for younger individuals with lower incomes, to enable them to get coverage. It's not the same comprehensive coverage because it's a catastrophic policy. It's not the same amount of financial protection that is available elsewhere through the insurance procured through the law. But nonetheless, it will allow you to fulfill the requirement to have insurance, pay less, and you will not have to avail yourself in that instance of the affordability exemption.
We're talking about the deadline coming next Monday for most Americans who don't currently have health insurance to sign up for insurance or face a fine, a penalty on your tax returns next year. Talking about it with Susan Denser, Senior Policy Advisor to the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. And here's an insurance broker calling in, Joy in Huntington. You're on WNYC. Hello, Joy.
Oh, yes. Hello. Am I on the air?
You are. Turn off your radio. Otherwise, you'll get confused
okay,
by the
I
delay.
Will. Your speaker is very informed, and it's taking a long time. I'm sure she's going nuts with all her information, but there is so much depravity. It's unbelievable. So, the real situations are the government is outreaching in just so many ways. Number one, we do have an industry that was bruised, and that is the broker insurance industry. And we do have now these non-for-profits that have offshoots of the government and have been in various states who have been providing health care to the Medicaid, who are now expanding and are in the broker division. Not to mention the compensation has basically been destroyed. There's no more compensation.
I don't want to get too far off on this tangent, but you're saying that Obamacare is bad for your industry, the certified insurance broker industry, because the business of signing people up for health insurance is migrating to others?
The business is not migrating to others. It's becoming completely government controlled. And in that, there is just inequity There was never a discussion. There were never laws passed. I'm sure the government is going to be facing enormous amounts of lawsuits from private insurance companies. Who knows?
Can you as a broker set someone up with an Obamacare exchange policy?
Oh yes, I have a 5 broker of letters in my release right now. I'm going to, but unfortunately, I'm going to pay a visit to a very sick Haitian employee that is a legitimate citizen who makes so far below, is in the poverty line, and has been declined disability. I don't want to get into my particulars in any way, but I am in the process of seeing so much poverty that I'm appalled. I can't believe the poverty and the status of the penalties. They're going to make the poverty even greater.
Joy, thank you for your call. But on that point, Susan Dentzer, and we talked earlier briefly about how there are hardship exemptions from having to buy health insurance and be covered. But if you really have financial hardship, if you're in poverty, then you're going to be eligible for Medicaid. So
yes.
Why is that exemption even relevant?
It is only relevant for a group of people who are frankly going to be, well, here's who it's relevant for. As we know, not all states have elected to expand their Medicaid programs. Only about half have. So there's going to be some pool of people who will arguably, for whatever reason, not going to be able to be covered by Medicaid through particular states, who may well fall into this situation where they will need to avail themselves of an affordability exemption. There's a whole other class of people who could apply for these hardship exemptions, and again, it's quite detailed. If you're homeless, if you were evicted in the past 6 months, if you got a shutoff notice from your utility, if you experienced domestic violence, if you had the death of a close family member and were so traumatized that you couldn't actually get yourself motivated to get coverage, if you were in a fire, a flood, if you filed for bankruptcy in the last 6 months, if you had medical expenses you couldn't pay in the last 2 years, if you expect that you're going to have a child who you will claim is a dependent who's been denied coverage in Medicaid and CHIP, and you cannot pay cover that child, you don't have to pay the penalty for that child. There are a lot of ways out of the payment of the penalty.
Let's see if Kylie in Bed-Stuy has one. I think she's calling about one. Kylie, you're on WNYC. Hi, Kylie. Nice to hear
Hello.
From you again.
So I know. So my question is, I just signed up for the Affordable Care Act, and I understand that so I'll be billed monthly, and if I don't pay that bill, I think 2 consecutive months, then the insurance company can drop me and drop my coverage. So if that were to happen, because it is a really hefty payment, to be perfectly honest, if that were to happen so that by the end of 2014, I no longer have health insurance coverage, could I end up with both a tax penalty from the government and a medical bill and an insurance bill from the insurance company?
Wow. Susan, how about that scenario?
Well, assuming that you've stopped paying the premium, obviously you're not going to pay the premium, right? But in that case, if you're not able to check that box on when you submit your tax return next year, you're likely going to have to pay the penalty.
But what does the box actually ask you? Is it, did you have health insurance at any time during 2014, or did you have it on this particular date? Do you know how that's going to be worded?
I honestly don't, and my sense is it's worth checking the IRS website, which is, to make this even more complicated, that whole set of that whole provision and the penalty is administered through the IRS. So you could take a look now and see if the IRS has put out information about what the tax returns for the current calendar year, 2014, are going to look like. Obviously, right now, most people are focused on filing their taxes for 2013 and dealing with the 2013 forms. But we'll see how, in fact, the IRS presents this on its 2014 form.
We're talking about the coming March 31st, that's next Monday, deadline for most Americans to have health insurance. So if you're uninsured, that means signing up through the Obamacare exchanges. But I want to interrupt for just a second because we have some breaking news relevant to the segment that we started the show with about an hour ago. Osama bin Laden's son-in-law has been convicted of both counts in his case. That's conspiring to kill Americans by serving as al-Qaeda spokesman after the September 11th attacks and of providing material support to al-Qaeda. So the terrorism trial in Lower Manhattan of Salamoun Abu Ghaith has just ended with guilty verdicts on both counts by the jury, thought you would like to know. But continuing with Susan Denser on Obamacare, I read that another exempt group, and watch this smooth segue into the Supreme Court story, another exempt group is people who have religious objections to having health insurance at all. I think you mentioned this briefly before, too. Do you know that to be true?
Yes. You have to file for those exemptions, however. So it's not as if there's a sort of a class, the government hasn't published a list of religions that you can be a member of and not have to have health insurance. If you want to find out more information about this, I heartily urge if you go to healthcare.gov/exemptions/, you will see a very detailed list for how to apply for these exemptions. And they include, it's not just religious beliefs. If you're in a so-called healthcare sharing ministry, if you are a member of a federally recognized tribe, Indian tribe, you can also apply. And you've got these options now of actually filling out the exemption application. And again, this is for, you can get exempted on affordability grounds. You can get exempted on these hardship grounds that we've talked about, as well as religious beliefs, being a member of the tribe, et cetera. And all of that information is spelled out in great detail on the healthcare.gov site.
And briefly on the Supreme Court case yesterday, how do you think it went if you follow this? I realize you're a healthcare policy analyst. You're not a Supreme Court reporter or a legal, but at issue was some for-profit companies' desire to not cover their employees for contraception, which the Affordable Care Act mandates be covered as part of basic universal health care. But once corporations start the law down that slope, the questions seem to go much deeper. Are they really arguing that any company can exempt themselves from any law of the United States based on the owner's religious beliefs? And can a corporation, as opposed to a person, be seen by the law as having a religion? So if you paid attention yesterday, Susan, how do you think it went for either side?
Well, as you suggested, the arguments were divided. The liberal, more liberal-leaning justices pressed very hard on the point that you made, which is that if you let companies get out of the responsibility to provide contraceptive coverage for religious beliefs, where does that stop? I mean, what else if they have a particular belief that somehow it's religiously wrong to enforce the minimum wage? Can they get out of that? So there was a lot of concern on the side of those liberal justices about that. Of course, as we know, the Supreme Court has ruled in another context that companies are people. In fact, they have the rights of persons with respect to free speech.
In the context
in the political
of
context. So,
campaign finance.
Exactly right. So there was a lot of argument on that side. What's really, I think, was most interesting to me, again, as you say, I'm not a person who covers the Supreme Court, but what I think is interesting is that no one is challenging the notion that these two companies and the families that run them can have a religious belief, which is that some forms of contraception cause abortion, when in fact the science on that is so ambiguous. The issue seems to be that these companies feel that, for example, IUDs cause abortion, or that emergency contraceptive pills cause abortion, whereas in fact the science would suggest that for example, if you have IUDs with copper in them, it appears that the copper in them actually may prevent sperm from fertilizing an egg. So it's not as if there's ever even a fertilized egg, let alone the ability of a fertilized egg not to implant. So what is very curious to me, and certainly was remarkable, is that nobody is even talking about the science and all of that. That's completely beside the boards. It's if a company believes, the family that owns a closely held company believes something, therefore they can act on that belief in this way. And that frankly, was what I was most struck by.
And, of course, religious exemptions can cut both ways, politically, depending on the issue. During Vietnam, liberals argued for and won the right to have a personal conscientious objector status to being drafted without it having to be couched in a formal religion. But the government's view here is there could be a religious exemption to a person having health insurance at all, as you described, but not to a company offering all the benefits of basic health insurance as required by law. So I guess we'll see at the end of June what the Supreme Court decides. But we will see next Monday how many Americans have signed up by the year one open enrollment deadline. And just tell us before you go, Susan Dentzer, very briefly about this exemption that the president's people announced yesterday, or I should say extension. So some people will get an extension, but not very many people, where if they're in the system in some way, they can go beyond next Monday?
Yes. In fact, people will have now until about the end of April. And that is for, we should emphasize here, that's for people who had attempted to sign up through healthcare.gov, the federal exchange. There's also the situation in a number of states that have had problems with their own exchanges, Maryland, Minnesota, Nevada, et cetera. They have also independently extended the sign-up period. So individuals in a number of those states will have more time to sign up as well. It's a self-attestation is the phrase. It means what you basically have to do is say that you signed up or you were attempting to sign up and you had trouble signing up, and you'll be able to sign up, which means, I think, in effect, a little-known analysis that the government put out back at the beginning of March suggested that there were almost 9 million people who had gone on exchanges both at the federal and state level and were determined to be eligible to enroll. So if, in fact, many of those individuals stay with it, we could see a dramatically higher enrollment in the next couple of weeks, and particularly now that we know it's going to go on through most of April.
And so much is at stake with how many people do enroll, because the economic underpinning is based on a lot of young, healthy people actually enrolling, and that'll prevent the premiums for next year from going up too much, which would prevent more people from signing up if those premiums do go up too much. So it's very, very crucial to the long-term success of the system how many people sign up by next Monday, or for some by the end of that extended period that you just described. Susan Dentzer, Senior Policy Advisor to the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, thank you so much for clearing so much up for so many listeners today. Thanks a lot.
Great to be with you.